Over the last few lectures and other lectures, we have encountered a lot of examples of topological twists, where you have some physical theory which has a certain amount of supersymmetry, and you pick a supercharge, you twist by that, you add it, you take it, you treat it as a differential, and you get a simpler theory which is perhaps topological. And also, when looking at boundary conditions of Chukwu-Machu models, we encounter a situation where this is inherited by a defect, meaning I have a physical defect which preserves some part of the supersymmetries of the physical theory, which include the topological supercharge. And then when I reduce by the topological supercharge, I get a topological defect in a topological field theory. Now, at the level, I'd like to discuss situations where this procedure can be repeated for defects, defects within defects, and so on. So I would like to discuss situations where you have some physical theory with some hierarchy of supersymmetric defects, and a property that when you do topological twist, you get a hierarchy of topological defects, which can be organized in some sort of higher categorical perspective, or extended topological field theory perspective. So this is a very restrictive demand. It's not easy to produce situations where this actually happens. And let me explain you why. Maybe I'll go there. So if I want a topological field theory in some number of dimensions, I want to have some differential. And then I want to have a bunch of homotopies for the translations. So in a sense, the underlying theory only really needs to have something like D+1 supersymmetries. Now in practice, you'll need more than that to be able to organize this as some kind of a twisted version of a spinner. But at the topological level, if I'm looking at the defect, say in D-1 dimension, and I want the defect to be topological, well, the defect will have to preserve Q, and you had to preserve, say, D-1 of these D homotopies. That should be enough. On the other hand, when you look at examples of physical defects which preserve some amount of supersymmetry in a physical supersymmetric field theory, you'll discover that you can never preserve more than half of the bulk supercharges. I don't know of any example where you can do that. For example, when you're studying Chukwu-Machu theories, the boundary condition preserves 2 out of 4. Justin introduced to you the idea that Chukwu-Machu supersymmetry can be embedded inside 3D n equal 4 supersymmetry. And indeed, one can define boundary condition in 3D n equal 4 theories which preserve Chukwu-Machu supersymmetry. They preserve 4 supercharges out of the 8 of 3D n equal 4, and so on and so forth. Which means that in order to have, say, D supersymmetries on the defect, I need to have at least 2D in the original theory. Now let me keep going. Suppose I want to have a defect within defects. See, I want to have a line inside a topological boundary. Well, now, it's true that topologically I only need to preserve D-1 of the supersymmetries. But in order for this to be a physical defect, to come from a physical defect embedded inside a physical higher dimensional defect, this other one would have to have 2 D-1 at least supercharges. And the original theory must have at least 4 D-1 supercharges. If you keep going all the way to line defects, when you preserve your usual Q and Q dagger of n equal to quantum mechanics. Well, the number of supersymmetries that you need in your original theory proliferates. You need at the very least 2 to the d supercharges in your original theory. But the number of supercharges in a quantum field theory, in an interactive quantum field theory at least, is bounded from above by 16. This is not a straightforward fact to prove. It can be proven in some situations. But for example, if you try to write down Lagrangians for some free fields, and then which admit interactions, you will find something like that. Pretty much because if your theory starts with, say, a scalar field, and you start acting supercharges on it, you produce fields with more and more Lorentz indices. If your scalar field was, say, massless, which is always something you can assume in the UV when you have written down your Lagrangian, all of these other fields will be massless too. And there are theories that say that massless fields of high spin cannot have interactions. There are no gauge invariant interactions for massless fields of higher spin. In conformal field theories, you can make arguments based on the stress tensor. You start from the stress tensor, you start acting on it with supercharges, and at some point, if you have more than 16, you land on operators on negative dimension, which is not okay in a unitary theory. Anyway, just believe this fact for now. You cannot have too many supercharges in a quantum field theory. You can have a few more if you have a gravity theory. You can go up to 32. So this means that these sort of games will only be available in dimensions smaller than or equal to 4. Yes, I'm assuming that I want to have a unitary physical supersymmetric field theory behind my topological twist. I don't need to, but we have a lot of results for physical theories that come from our physical intuition, from string theory and whatnot. And if you want to carry over those results to your topological twisted theories, well, you kind of need to have a physical theory behind. So Justin already almost gave us all the information we need. I just need to add an extra step, meaning here, I need an equal to quantum mechanics to go to 2D. I can have a 2,2 supersymmetry algebra, and then this sits inside a 3D n equal 4, which can sit inside 4D n equal 4. So if you start from here, you can get some topological one-dimensional theories. If you start from here, you can get a topological two-dimensional theory with topological boundaries. If you start from here, you can get three-dimensional topological field theories with a two-category of boundary conditions whose morphisms are topological lines. And if you start from here, you can hope to get a three-category of topological boundary conditions. I mean, you can opt to get a four-dimensional topological field theory, which has a three-category of topological boundary conditions, with morphisms are two categories of surfaces, and so on and so forth. Okay. So I would like to discuss a bit three-dimensional equal four supermeals and the sort of embeddings of supersymmetry algebras associated to this feature. As I said, you don't have to do this. There are clearly a lot of other interesting amounts of supersymmetry which allow interesting twists. For example, 4D n equal 2 has a Donaldson twist. But I wanted to sort of capture the twists for which are the maximal structural defects. So As I mentioned, for the N equal 4 supermean sense is a theory with 16 supercharges. This is extremely restrictive. If you try to write down Lagrangian with 16 supercharges and interactions, you should land on just a unique answer, which depends only on the choice of a gauge group. So it's going to be a gauge theory, first of all. And it's going to be labeled by a gauge group. So and actually, here, if I really don't want to say a lie, I should say it's labeled by gauge algebra. Which is what you would use to write down the Lagrangian, right? You know, your connection lives in, say, in the joint of the Abelian algebra and so on. And then you add to this some topological data. Which could be the choice of a group for which G is a Abelian algebra, or could be something else. It's a very fun story, and perhaps I may get to it towards the very end of the lecture. But for now, if your objective is to just write down the field content and the Lagrangian, you only need the Abelian algebra. So what are the fields? There is a connection. Okay, I'll start. I hope I write things correctly. Mathematically, I always not very good at that. Anyway, there are some fermions which are called gauginos. Which are chiral spinners or under chiral spinners, and there are four of each. So let me take a four-dimensional vector space, let me call it V4, and the transform under dual. So one lives in V4 and the other lives in the dual of V4. And then there are some scalar fields. Here, I really mean intersections of, sorry. which are just functions. And there are six of them organized in antisymmetric second antisymmetric power with 4, which has been identified with the second antisymmetric power of the dual of V4 by using, so V4 is equipped with an epsilon tensor with a volume, with a top form. So what are the symmetries to this theory? Well, of course, there are translations. There are some chiral supercharges which live in S plus and in V dual. Some anti-chiral supercharges which live in S minus and in V, tensor V. And then there are some R symmetries which rotate, which act on V. And you see, because I needed an identification between the second symmetric power of V and V dual, there are symmetry generators. Are generators for an SU4 R symmetry. So essentially, they're traceless. So writing the supersymmetry algebra is straightforward given these symmetries.
So it was supposed to be A beta B. A B.
So identify translations with B-spinors. You could add central charges, let me not do that. Now, the action of the supercharges on the fields is also quite constrained by the symmetries. Schematically, if you start from your connection or the scalar fields, they're sent by Qs and Q bars to your lambdas, which then are sent to the by Qs and Q bars to the derivatives of these fields, the field strength and the derivatives of the scalars. And I invite you as exercise number one to write down some reasonable action of the supersymmetries for the U1 gauge theory. Now, the fact that there are symmetry is SU4 rather than U4 has an important consequence. The consequence that if you're given your theory, you cannot freely redefine Q and Q dagger by a phase. Right? If you just look at the supersymmetry algebra, you might think that you can just rescale all the Qs by some phase, rescale the dagger by the opposite phase, and everything would be fine. So at the level of the algebra, you could have a U4 R symmetry. But the actual physical theory only has SU4 R symmetry. Now, the most crucial property of this for supermeters is called as duality. And I want to discuss it briefly in this context. But first of all, I need to discuss the Lagrangian of the theory. So the amount of supersymmetry really constrains the possible couplings of the theory. As I said, Lagrangian is written down essentially uniquely once you tell me the gauge group. And it has one coupling for every simple factor. So this Lie-algebra is semi-simple in a physical theory, and each reductive, and in each factor inside has its own gauge group gauge coupling. So schematically, the Lagrangian for the gauge fields. As the usual Jan-Mills term, and also a topological term, which does not affect the equations of motion. It affects the quantization of the theory, but also affects the boundary conditions of the theory, classically. So the point is that the variation of this term is a total derivative, but it still gives contributions to the boundary. Now, once you write down the action for the gauge fields, everything else is fixed. So there will be some lambda to lambda, and some maybe phi squared. Now, if you consider abelian gauge theories, not even supersymmetric, just pure abelian gauge theory, there is an interesting manipulation, it's called electromagnetic duality. Sorry, I was writing, you're right. There are extra interaction terms. Sorry. So electromagnetic duality at the level of the equations of motion is just the statement that you can replace the field strength with its such dual without changing the equations of motion. The equations of motion written in terms of the field strength are something like df is 0, d star f is 0. Now, if you try to write f in terms of a connection, the relation of course becomes a little bit messier, but a way to understand it is that if I have an action which is dA squared, I can replace it by an equivalent action F squared plus dA wedge B, where B acts as a Lagrange multiplier, df, which B, to force F to be locally closed and so locally exact. And then you can integrate by parts and integrate away F to get to an equivalent Lagrangian, which is dB squared. Now, if you're a little bit more precise and you include a coupling, when you integrate by part, when you integrate away f as a Gaussian, you just end up with g squared here. So electromagnetic duality exchanges the coupling with the inverse coupling in the absence of theta angle. If you do the calculation a little bit more carefully in the presence of the theta angle, it's convenient to combine the theta angle with the gauge coupling, ignoring all sorts of factors of pi. And then you can check the electromagnetic duality exchanges tau with minus 1 over tau. Just straightforward calculation. Let me call it exercise 2. Now, the theta angle is actually periodic. That's why it's called an angle. If you shift it by 2 pi, because this integral is always an integer, or I mean, not precise about integer or even integer or things like that, it means that the path integral does not change if you shift theta by a multiple of 2 pi. Or equivalently, shift tau to tau plus 1. This operation, though, does not commute electromagnetic duality. So you can get a larger set of equivalences of this theory, where you combine shifts by an integer or inversion. So these things together give you transformations that map tau to A tau plus B over C tau plus D. So this is called the group of electromagnetic dualities of your theory. So this holds with some simple manipulations of Lagrangian at the level of the abelian gauge theory. Much more mysteriously, it holds also in the non-abelian theory. Although you might have to replace the group with its Langland dual group, sorry, the algebra with its Langland dual algebra when you do this operation. So in the non-abelian case, you might need to do G goes to G Langland dual. The duality acts on this extra topological data in very interesting ways, when this topological data is expressed in terms of a Lie group, the group of gauge transformations, it acts pretty much as Langland duality for the group, up to some subtleties. But then this operation changes the topological data in a way that brings you out of that class of specified gauge group. So what is the precise topological data which defines the four-dimensional gauge theory? It's an interesting question. I would actually love to have a mathematical discussion of that. Perhaps looking at this theory and asking what is the universal bulk in the sense of Dillon, and then looking for topological boundary conditions for that universal bulk, which allow you to get true for the theory. It's an invitation, research project, find a mathematical discussion of this. And there are actually interesting subtleties which have to do with the possible choices of spin structure for the manifold in which you're living. Find a mathematical characterization of the topological data needed to fully specify a four-dimensional N equal 4 gauge theory.
What kind of answer do you expect?
At least part of the answer should be something like a Lagrangian splitting of the weight lattice times the co-weight lattice. But there are a bit of more subtleties than that. They have to do with spin choices of spin structure, and I don't fully understand. Perhaps the word quadratic refinement enters somewhere. Discussing this would really bring me very far from what I can discuss now. But I'd be very happy to discuss this in detail in the afternoon. Now, not only the topological data, but figure out how this duality acts on this topological data. Now, an interesting fact is that this S duality acts in a non-trivial way also on the supersymmetry algebra. So when you do these sort of transformations, your supercharges are multiplied by some phase, which depends on A, B, C. Actually, I think only on C, D, and tau. I think it's something like the phase of C tau plus D, but I haven't checked it in a while. As I said, this is a non-trivial operation because there is no R symmetry which can undo it. The way it comes about is that the action of Q and Q dagger on lambda treats quite differently F. So F mu nu is a true form in R4. It can be decomposed into self-dual and anti-self-dual parts, which live in the symmetric product of S plus and S minus. And electromagnetic, so these are something like F plus I star F. And this is something like F minus I star F. And so when you exchange F and star F, you populate a variety of interesting phases, which have to be undone by some phase redefinition of the supercharges. I mean, roughly under tau goes to 1 over tau, what happens is that these self-dual and anti-self-dual parts of F get multiplied by something like tau and tau bar, respectively. And the supercharges also end up being multiplied by some phases. So now let's discuss some embeddings of superalgebras. So suppose I want to embed the 3D supersymmetry algebra inside the 4D supersymmetry algebra. In order to do that, I need to pick a direction in 4D, direction orthogonal to these three-dimensional directions. So somehow I'm decomposing R4 to R3 plus R. And the spinor, when you look at the spinor representations and how they transform under the SO3 rotational symmetry of 3D, you'll discover that they go to the same spinor representation in 3D. So S plus and S minus can be identified when I do that. So essentially what happens is that this becomes something like this. So once I identify them, I can separate the antisymmetric and symmetric part, and these are the translations in along R or along R3. So if I want to find a collection of supercharges which only anticommutes to these, but not that, right? I'll have to find a natural way to project out the antisymmetric combination here. Now the whole thing is symmetric under exchanging. A natural way to do so is to take a sum of Q and Q dagger, Q and Q bar. So the three-dimensional supercharges are going to be just some linear combination of the Qs and the Q bars. But now, in order to add up Qs and Q bars, I need to also pick some identification between V and V dual. More precisely, in order to to find a projection to 3D supercharges, we need to find the metric on V4. So this will break the SU4 asymmetry to SO4 asymmetry, which is natural asymmetry in 3D. So once I do that, I can just write something like this, and it's harmless. The only choice I need, but I still need to choose a relative phase between Qs and Q bars. Maybe I should put something like e to the I omega over 2, e to the minus I omega over 2 to keep thing real. Think it really, you know? So because my aforementioned asymmetry is SU4 and not U4, I get a whole family of inequivalent embeddings of the 3D supersymmetry algebra inside the 4D supersymmetry algebra.
This is an S1 family.
Right? S1 family, which is there even after I've made my choices of embedding of the Lorentz group and our symmetry group. So now I can define a half BPS boundary condition as something that preserves these three-dimensional cues. One choice of these three-dimensional cues. Now, this is a nice definition, but now you should ask yourself, can we actually find boundary conditions because that's supersymmetry? And the result, the answer is surprisingly intricate and interesting. So my exercise 3 is to find half BPS Dirichlet boundary conditions in the abelian gauge theory. Dirichlet boundary conditions means that I want the connection along the boundary to vanish. So you can take this condition and sort of trying to find boundary conditions for the spinners and the scalars, which are compatible with this. And what can go wrong is that you might end up imposing too many conditions on some of the scalars and too few on some of the others. See, it's never okay to take a scalar field and say, I want the value of the scalar field and its normal derivative to vanish at the boundary. Because that's not a Lagrangian, not an elliptic boundary condition in the phase space, not a Lagrangian in the phase space. You can only do things like, I pick this scalar to vanish, or I pick its normal derivative to vanish, or perhaps I pick a linear combination of two scalars and say that this linear combination vanishes at the boundary, and a certain orthogonal normal derivative also vanishes. So you can do various combinations, but you cannot just over-constrain a single field. And this actually, so typically, whenever you try to produce a boundary condition, it turns out that this parameter omega is fixed as a function of tau and the specific form of the boundary condition. For example, for Dirichlet boundary conditions, if I remember correctly, omega has to be 0 or 2 pi. Or pi. Now, in the abelian theory, you can start from Dirichlet boundary conditions and apply electromagnetic dualities to the bulk theory and see what happens. For example, Dirichlet boundary condition is invariant under a shift of the bulk theta angle, but it transforms into Neumann under tau goes to minus 1 over tau. And the Neumann boundary condition is not invariant under a shift of the theta angle. And so you get a whole family of boundary conditions. And then you start applying electromagnetic duality again, and so on and so forth. The result is that you get a two-parameter. There are a two-parameter family of boundary conditions which are obtained from Dirichlet. Let me sketch it a little bit. So there is Dirichlet. Let me call this operation tau goes to tau plus 1 t, and tau goes to minus 1 over tau s. So if I start from Dirichlet boundary conditions in an abelian theory, is invariant under t. But it's sent by s to Neumann. If I apply t on Neumann, I get a new family of boundary conditions where roughly you add boundary Chern-Samos couplings to your Neumann. So these are called 1, k boundary conditions. Oh, maybe I should call Neumann 1, k. But then if you apply S, you get even new boundary conditions, which are called Neumann minus k, 1. And then you can apply T, and so on and so forth. The process actually stops. It stops to a whole two-parameter family, which you could call Neumann p, q, where p and q are coprime. The boundary condition themselves are not terribly complicated. It's just that they set to zero some specific linear combination of the field strength at the boundary and the dual of the field strength at the boundary. And the specific linear combination is controlled by tau and by P and Q.
Can you repeat? You said something about Neumann 1K and putting a Chern-Simons on the boundary?
Yes. I mean, if you can imagine that, I erased it, but if I shift the theta angle by 2 pi, the action changes by total, by the integral of f wedge f. That's the total derivative of the Chern-Samos action. So I integrate by part and I slap the Chern-Samos action on the boundary. This does nothing to Dirichlet because the connection is zero at Dirichlet. But it does something to Neumann. And anyway, so here you could repeat the calculation. You will find that, again, for a choice of PQ Neumann, omega will be there will be a pair of omegas that depend on tau, p, and q. So this is just to say that although you can find a lot of interesting boundary conditions just in the bare theory without even adding boundary degrees of freedom, very few of these boundary conditions can talk simultaneously with the same topological twist, or with this sort of extended topological setup, because they just don't share a common 3D N equal 4. Unless you can pose restrictions on tau, which ameliorate the situation a little bit. For example, if the theta angle is zero, Neumann and Dirichlet are both compatible with omega equal to zero or omega equal to pi. But none of the other PQs are. Then you can enrich the story further by trying to add boundary degrees of freedom, which are 3D N equal 4 supersymmetry and are coupled to you can make enriched Neumann boundary condition when I take some three-dimensional degrees of freedom and you couple them to Neumann boundary conditions. Again, that's pretty harmless when that theta angle equals to zero. It becomes trickier when that theta angle is non-zero. But so just to say that, especially when the tetangle is equal to zero, this setup does offer you a way to have a nice extended topological field theory structure within the context of topologically twisted physical quantum field theories. So the sort of structures that you are getting, if we start from 3D, we can get a 3D TFT, right, with 2D topological boundary conditions and lines, and 1D topological lines between boundary conditions. And if I start from 4D super Emils with a proper twist, I can get the topological field theory, which has three-dimensional topological boundary conditions, three-dimensional surfaces, two-dimensional surfaces, topological surfaces, which interpolate between boundary conditions, and then even one-dimensional topological lines between these junctions. And it's a nice playground, especially for geometric representation theory. It allows to generalize a lot of nice things that have been done for 3D and equal 4 theories, for example, like the BFM construction. It has some limitations, because there is a whole universe of interesting things that you cannot talk about. That's right. You cannot talk about them at once. And often, if you try to talk about these ones, you might have to pick a tau which is not weakly coupled. And so that really prevents you from talking about them in a perturbative way.
But there's still, you can still do a topological twist, right?
Yes. That's true. But you can always pretty much equivalently do a duality transformation to go back to this. So you don't really gain something truly new. Or maybe you do. I have not explored it as much as I should do. Before I go on, I would like to mention that the existence of a physical theory behind this structure and the existence of this large amount of supercharges still has interesting consequences. For example, here, nobody forces you to only study lines which are on top of 2D defects. You can study a bulk line. Now, of course, you can think about this as sort of an endomorphism of the trivial interface, and that's fine. But that would hide the fact that these one-dimensional topological lines can actually preserve 4 supercharges, not just 2. So here there is some category of bulk lines, a sort of topological one-dimensional lines in the bulk. There are a variety of ways to get these topological objects starting from the physical theory. The most obvious is to take quarter BPS lines, physical lines. These preserve 2 out of 8 supercharges. So they sort of naturally live in the category, differential graded category world. But you can study half BPS lines. And this one will give you structures which have n equal 4 quantum mechanics in there. So we'll go to the sort of points we briefly discussed in the previous lecture. So these ones will be some interesting collection of these lines. Maybe a T structure or heart. I don't know. I can say words I don't understand. It's not terribly useful.
Can you give me an example? I mean, are you going to give any concrete examples
Depending on time, I'll try. But there is another way to get objects in here, because in the topological field theory, the definition of line is quite loose. It pretty much means whatever you can do to fill in a cylinder in a topological way. This category of lines is really what the 3D theory attaches to a circle in the extended topological field theory language. And in particular, you can take lines which are secretly boundary conditions which have been rolled up into a thin cylinder. So you can start from 2D physical boundary conditions and roll them up into a cylinder to get a topological line. This sort of a kind of a forgetful function, and it takes something from a shoe category and maps it to a one category. And as I said, they all live in the same topological world, but physically they are very different. And again, you can ask yourself, how do I recognize inside here things that come from a physical line, from a half EPS line, or something, or things that come from a rolled up boundary condition?
Can you say what that vertical arrow is again? You have this cylinder where the 2D boundary condition is, and then...
Essentially, I take a boundary, and I map it to the object that the boundary associates to a circle. So, for example, in some situations, this category will look like, I don't know, sheaves or demodules, maybe demodules on some loop space. And the line defects will tend to give you objects which depend on sort of a Fourier decomposition on the loop, where you say modes that sort of can be continued in a way which is sort of your object is supported on the modes which can be continued to the inside of the disk. I will give something more concrete later. I don't think now I should discuss it. But let's just say that whenever you're inside this structure, you'll find substructures which are interesting, and which have, in a way, which is associated to extra supersymmetry, but in different ways. So for example, these lines, as I said, have an n=4 supersymmetric quantum mechanics, which extends the n=2 quantum mechanics here. On the other hand, a boundary condition has a 2,2 supersymmetry algebra. And when you roll it up on a circle, you still have 4 supercharges, except that some anti-commute to the rotations of the circle. Right. All of these structures should have a mathematical image. And you can imagine that things get even more intricate and interesting here when you study, say, 1D lines in 4D. Now, the lines that are available in a specific... So something happens similar happens for lines as it happens for boundary conditions. This gauge theory has a large variety of types of lines which are acted upon by S-duality. And different types of lines are compatible with different topological twists. But for example, the simplest kind of lines are Wilson lines, which classically measure the holonomy of the line in some representation. So in particular, there are half BPS lines which are labeled by representations of your Lie algebra or group. On the other hand, in the sort of categorical world, right, there will be some category of Wilson lines. in inverted commas, meaning that they include quarter BPS Wilson lines, so even 8 BPS Wilson lines. After all, I only need 2 out of the 16 superchargers which live in the environment. And perhaps they involve rolled up boundary conditions, or rolled up surface defects, or whatnot. Now, as duality relates Wilson lines to something called Tuft lines. Now, Tuft lines are analogous to the monopole operators that are defined for you in 3D. They're constructed by saying, I do a path integral where the connection has some flux on the two spheres surrounding the line. Again, there will be some differential graded category of things that look like Tuft lines. And inside there, there will be half BPS Tuft lines, quarter BPS Tuft lines, and so on. Now, the equivalence as duality implies an equivalence between these two categories, which should be derived geometrically stacked. So if the words derived geometrically stacked mean something to you, then you can start exploring these sort of questions of what different kind of objects look like on the two sides of geometric satake. You might ask yourself if there are some nice things inside of there, which could be perhaps quarter BPS objects inside the 8 BPS, I mean some hearts that are compared on the two sides. Anyway, this should be an interesting example to start looking at these problems.
So is it not known which objects inside the Satake category are 1/2, 1/4, and 1/8?
Well, the half BPS are just representations of the Lie algebra.
Yes, which is like some sort of underived.
Totally underived. That's right. Which I think is smaller than the heart of a T-structure, I've been told by Phil.
It's the heart of a T-structure.
But perhaps you can extend it to something.
But I see. And but you don't know which ones are the 1/4 BPS.
No, I do not know. I do not know.
The 1/8 BPS lines, the ones that are at least 1/8 BPS should be like the full.
The full side. And it would be interesting to sort of connect each piece, you know, it should be doable, at least on the Wilson loop side, in a straightforward way. No, given a physical line, where will it end? Given a physical boundary condition rolled up, where will it end? And then you can apply geometric satake, and you get some more non-trivial statements here about Tuft lines. Well, quarter BPS will go to quarter BPS. A rolled up boundary will go to a rolled up boundary.
Preserves those.
Right, that's right. So here you have some demodules on the fine Grassmannian, I believe. It's equivariant demodules on the fine Grassmannian, which should be a mathematical way to think about the notion of monopole operator, sort of a Hecke transformation. Right, and you can sort of figure out which the modules correspond to various things. Okay. So as I said, this is definitely a fun story and with a lot of interesting applications. And I think Justin, Phil could tell you a lot of interesting things about this. The dictionary is being developed. But now I would like to switch to an interesting modification of this setup. So So as I said, in this setup, all these variety of boundary conditions don't really talk to each other in a nice way. But I would like to argue in the next few minutes that there are ways to deform these objects so that they end up all sitting in the same world. They sit in the same world, but not in a fully topological way. Meaning that if I try to look at junctions between them in this deformed world, these junctions are not topological. Instead, they are holomorphic. Meaning that they support vertex algebras of local operators. So I would like to explore a situation where this picture is replaced by a picture where I don't have 2D topological things, but I have 2D holomorphic things at the boundary of 3D topological things. And I still have topological lines in 3D, maybe, and topological boundaries too. And these are will have to talk in interesting ways to the holomorphic things. And similarly here, I want to leave the four-dimensional and three-dimensional parts topological, but replace the junctions between boundary conditions with something holomorphic. And then again, there will be interesting things like boundary lines ending on this holomorphic locus, or perhaps 2D surface, 2D topological things, ending on the boundaries and intersecting the holomorphic locus at one point. So how do I get there? So Justin introduced the first ingredients that we need to do this in his lecture. So he was mentioning that a 3D Nicol Four theory has two topological twists, and that in a very precise sense, they can be thought of as deformations of an holomorphic twist. So I'm saying I can just take the Q plus supercharge, okay? And then you can deform it to things like Q plus epsilon Q minus plus minus, or Q plus epsilon prime Q minus plus. And these supercharges give you topological twists. Well, this doesn't give an holomorphic twist. Now, the holomorphic twist is compatible with a lot of physical boundary conditions. So I can have a situation where I had a 3D holomorphic twist, and have a boundary which is the standard 2,2 boundary with an holomorphic twist. And then the deformation will map it to something topological and 2D topological with no effort, meaning that this theory, this boundary preserves Q, this supercharge, but it also preserves this 2, or this 2. On the other hand, I can consider other possibilities where I take a physical boundary condition, which, for example, has 0,4 preserves 0,4 supersymmetry. Means that it preserves all the chiral supercharges and none of the antichiral ones. This is still compatible with the holomorphic twist, but at least naively, it's not compatible with the topological twists because it's breaking the supercharges. Now, what can happen is that although the physical boundary condition breaks these supercharges, the holomorphically twisted one doesn't. It's not impossible. Essentially, the breaking of the supercharge essentially means that some supercurrent brought to the boundary is non-zero. But it might be that it's non-zero, but it's Q exact. So within the holomorphic theory, you can study these nilpotent supersymmetries and ask if these nilpotent supersymmetries happen to be preserved by the holomorphic twist or the boundary condition. And sometimes they are. Rarely, but sometimes they are. And if they are, it means that this picture can be deformed to the topological twist in the bulk at the price of deforming the boundary condition, not just changing the supercharge we're preserving. Now, the deformed boundary condition will preserve much less than zero force supersymmetry. It really only needs to preserve this topological supercharge, or this one. But it has no reason to become topological, in general, doesn't. Precisely because when I do this deformation, I'm breaking almost all of the other supersymmetries. And so if I'm breaking them, they cannot be used to make translations homotopic, or homotopically trivial. Right, in this setup, del bar was homotopically trivial, but del was not. And this boundary condition just does not have the supersymmetry that I need to make del trivial. So I land with an holomorphic boundary condition for a topological field theory. And you can do a similar analysis for the super Camille's. And actually, this allows you to explore the whole space of GL twisted for the super Yamils. The GL twisted for the super Yamils is a topological field theory which depends on a topological coupling psi or kappa. I like kappa recently, but used to be called psi. It inherits S-duality. So the S-duality of the UV theory, or the physical theory, becomes an S-duality which just acts on psi. In the usual, in the obvious way, psi goes to 1 over psi, or psi goes to psi plus 1. And so I can live in a world where I have this generic twist, at topological boundary conditions, but I have holomorphic junctions, where I can find some vertex algebras. In order to illustrate to you which kind of vertex algebras do I find there, I should go back to discussing Chern-Simons theory and boundary conditions of Chern-Simons theory. After all, Chern-Simons theory is the first place where you would ever encounter holomorphic boundary conditions for a topological field theory. So let me switch gear. So when I say I do the same thing here, I really mean that a lot of the boundary conditions I was discussing admit 0,4 junctions, and then which are compatible with an holomorphic topological twist of the 4D theory. And then these holomorphic topological twists can be deformed into twists which are equivalent to the generic geometric Langlands. And as I do this deformation, I can carry along the topological boundary conditions, and they remain topological. But the 0,4 junctions were holomorphic and remain holomorphic. But anyway, three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory. So we have been given a very nice perturbative description of Chern-Simons theory in previous lectures. It's a topological theory, and it really doesn't have many local operators, at least naively. Because after all, the field, naively the operators are polynomials in the field strength, but the classical equation of motion set the field strength to zero. So classically, there are no local operators. The Chern-Simons theory admits Wilson lines, which are classically labeled by representations of your group. They are defined as sort of part order exponential of a contrasted with some matrices which define the action of A on your representation. Now, again, what are the local operators that can live on a line? Naively, nothing. Not the identity. And also, perturbatively, you would never be able to connect two Wilson lines in different representations. In order to make such a junction, you would need some local operator built out of your fields, which live in the representation endomorphism of R into R prime. But there are no local operators. The field strength is zero, so nothing like this is possible. So perturbative home from WR to WR prime is sort of del of RR prime C. Now, these perturbative answers are wrong, simply wrong. They're wrong because quantum field theories have more local operators than the ones built as out as polynomials of the fields. So they're wrong at finite coupling. They're perturbatively correct. They're just wrong at finite coupling. Now, how would I study local operators in a bit of a more non-perturbative way? A nice trick is to use the state operator map. And instead of studying local operators, I can study the states on the sphere surrounding the local operator. So that means I will look at the phase space for a sphere with two of these representation insertions. Well, you see, there is a sphere surrounding the junction. It's pierced by the Wilson lines in two points. So I should study the space of states of Chern-Simons theory on a sphere in the presence of two auxiliary representations. Actually, I'm not sure this still allows you to see what you really would need to see. There is a further manipulation which is useful, which is to replace coupling to a finite dimensional representation, to coupling to quantum mechanics living in the flag manifold. Geometric quantization of that flag manifold would give you the representation you want, and it's perhaps a better way to describe the representation, because this way you're just a gigantic phase space of flat connections and flags, and they are trying to quantize that. Anyway, if you do this exercise, you'll learn that actually these morphisms can be non-trivial when the representations are different. And part of the result is that a lot of these Wilson lines turn out to be equivalent in the topological field theory, because you can find invertible morphisms between them. And that's the reason in HSM1's theory. The Wilson lines are not really represented by labeled representations of the group, but by smaller and more interesting categories, which have braiding, non-trivial braiding, but also are finitely many simple objects instead of infinitely many. Now, I'm not going to use any of these, because what I'm interested in is much more perturbative in nature. But I just wanted to mention it, to say this is a very nice example where you can understand sort of non-disorder local operators.
Did you have a polarization of the base case in mind?
Possibly. I guess you can compute it however you want, but the answer should not depend on the...
But was there one you were thinking would lead to like a nice answer or something?
Possibly. I've not done the calculations, so I have no prejudice.
What was the sort of mistake that I made in my first calculation?
The mistake is that a local operator is everything you can do to the theory which is local. And inserting an elementary field is one of the things you can do. But there are many other things you can do.
But the small sphere didn't look exactly local.
That's right. So here I'm using a non-trivial statement that is the state operator map. So, as I said, because the local operator is whatever you can do, it's hard to constrain what whatever you can do is. On the other hand, once you use a state operator map, you map it to the problem of find the Hilbert space on the sphere. That's a very constrained problem. So it seems a reasonable way to get a good answer. And I think that in a lot of situations, geometric quantization can already allow you to get a lot of interesting pieces of information. So now let's consider three-dimensional Chern-Simons with a two-dimensional boundary condition. Now, which boundary conditions can we set in Chern-Simons theory? So if I really am set to work with Chern-Simons theory without adding things like a Milstrom to the action, then the action is first order, right? The components of the connection can be thought of as both positions and momenta. So if I try to define boundary conditions, there is no way I can do something like I set the connection to zero, or I let the connection free to fluctuate at the boundary. Because this would be analogous in a problem of a scalar field to trying to set both the boundary condition and the normal component, normal derivative, to zero, or to let them both free to fluctuate. It's not okay. I need, my phase space is flat connections on the surface, and I need a Lagrangian sum manifold in there. So a natural choice is to set the anti-holomorphic component of the connection at the boundary to zero and leave the holomorphic connection free to fluctuate. Now, notice that in order to do so, I had to introduce a complex structure on the boundary. So it's the first hint that this is not going to be a topological boundary condition. Well, the second hint just stares you in the face. A or at Z. Actually, to do this, I need to impose also Dirichlet. Sorry, I need to say that the gauge transformation go to 1 at the boundary. You can check this is a good, well-defined boundary condition. And then the holomorphic component of A at the boundary is a perfectly good local operator. And in order for it to be flat, it must be holomorphic. So this boundary condition is a nice collection of holomorphic local operators called A of Z. So these local operators form a vertex algebra. This is what happens universally when you have a chiral local operators. And you can try to compute what is the OPE of two currents, of two of these A's, sorry. I suspect you'll find something like one over the level, that's 1/z² in a billion key, in a billion. In the non-abelian, you'll find some modification of that, which gives you Kac-Moody. So essentially, you discover that 1/k A of Z gives you a boundary Kac-Moody algebra. But this is a perturbative calculation still, right? I really took operators built out of elementary fields and I did the OPE. Yeah. This answer is, again, wrong. A finite level. If you want to get the real answer, you should surround this point to the little hemisphere and study the space of states on this hemisphere or disk, with these boundary conditions. And I invite you to try to do this calculation. At least for finding the phase space. Find the phase space which has some austere on a disk with AZ bar equal to 0 boundary conditions. And gauge transformations which vanish at the boundary. So you can compute a phase space, and then perhaps by some geometric quantization, you can find the Hilbert space attached to the disk. And this should be the same as the true observables, not perturbative. And hopefully, in doing so, you will land on the definition of WZW vertex algebra. So the WZW vertex algebra differs from the Kac-Moody algebra in two ways. It has more generators if the group is not simply connected, and it has and some null vectors have been quotiented away. So that this is a nice rational vertex algebra, meaning it has a finite collection of modules which form a nice modular tensor category. On the other hand, this one has a much more complicated collection of category of modules. Now, when you have two-dimensional holomorphic boundary conditions, you can think about the endpoints of one-dimensional lines on the boundary. So there will be some space of local operators at this point. And there will be operations which allow you to bring other chiral operators to this place. So there is kind of a functor from 1D lines to modules for the boundary vertex algebra. And so there is a very close relation between the fact that the whistle lines in the bulk become a finite collection, after I include non-perturbative monopoles, and the fact that this vertex algebra is rational. So a nice physical three-dimensional topological field theory is described by a modular tensor category. And this modular tensor category has a close relation to the modular tensor category of WZW modules.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Like, should I think that the extra boundary numbers are just
gone
by taking those extra
boundaries? Yes, absolutely. At least morally. it's a difference between thinking about perhaps the Grassmannian versus equivariant Grassmannian. It would be the sphere versus the disk. But yes, that morally was what should be happening. So a line that disappears is a line that can end on a bulk monopole. And then if I bring it bulk monopole in, this will give me a new local operator. Now, so the Chesemos theory was just a true physical topological field theory. But a lot of these structures should persist if you look at homotopic topological field theories. So for example, I was drawing this picture of 3D n equal 4 topologically twisted and 2D holomorphic boundary condition. I would again expect this holomorphic boundary condition to support some vertex algebra and the bulk lines to have some relation with the modules of this vertex algebra. And so all of the discussion I had about topological lines which are true lines or half BPS lines or rolled up boundary conditions should manifest itself in the possible modules for this boundary vertex algebra. Am I looking at just modules of vertex algebra? Am I looking at differential graded modules, perhaps? Or something else? I don't know the full story, but this is definitely a way you could use to probe it. But I wanted to close with a nice construction that will teach you how to compute the vertex algebra for one of these corner configurations, one of these configurations in four-dimensional gauge theory. So here there were a lot of non-perturbative subtleties, which had to do with, we're trying to actually quantize things at finite level. The level had to be integer, otherwise the path integral was not single valued, and so on and so forth. But in perturbation theory, I can make sense of Chesemos' theory with generic level, which perhaps not integer. And I could also try to do my path integral over integration cycles, which are different from the ones of the physical theory, which maybe can kill some of these non-perturbative effects. So one way to address this would be to use Dillon discussion of universal bulk theories. So you can try to build a four-dimensional topological field theory with a boundary condition such that the calculations done for these boundary conditions will mimic calculations in Chesemos' theory for generic level kappa. And it turns out that this one is just the GL twisted superior Mills. And this one is just the deformed Neumann compatible with that twist. Now, suppose I try to study Shan-Simons theory in the presence of an holomorphic boundary. I can apply the discussion of the universal bulk to the combination of this 3D theory and the 2D boundary. And the result will be a 3D, 4D theory with another 3D boundary condition, topological, which turns out to be the same as Dirichlet for the GL-twisted theory. No, it's topological. You need less than that. Some of this construction of universal bulk does not require.
I would have thought that the theorem supported the holomorphic thing, but these are holomorphic topological.
I think the point is that this is still Lagrangian in some sense. I don't know. Symplectic, sorry. So I don't know how to do the calculations in the Dillon framework, but I know that if you analyze this in the gauge theory and you really write down the boundary condition, you get something that is topological. Sorry, I should be careful. It's topological, but still requires a complex structure. It has no local operators, but it's sort of the formation of the Dirichlet boundary conditions, which makes it compatible with this. Still depends on the choice of complex structure on the surface in 2D. It just depends on it in a very mild way. It's like, right? It's topological. It's holomorphic. It's homotopically topological. Now, what do I find here? So here I'm learning what lives at the junction between Neumann and Dirichlet. Katz-Moody. After all, this setup is cooked up in such a way that whatever calculations I do here will be the same as doing calculations here, perturbatively. And so this is an example of this 2D junction of two topological boundary conditions, which supports a nice vertex algebra. And now you can ask yourself which Katz-Moody modules are associated to lines, which Katz-Moody modules are associated to surfaces that extend in the bulk, and so on and so forth. And this has all sorts of interesting applications to geometric Langlands, local geometric Langlands, and so on. OK, I think this is a good place to stop.